feel for you.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are about to have a conversation with Kurt Schmoke, who, of course, was the first African-American elected mayor of Baltimore City, and now, of course, president of the University of Baltimore after being dean of Howard University Law School. And as a disclaimer, a loud disclaimer, in all conversations I have for total transparency here on the Mark Steiner Show, I've known Kurt Schmoke for a long, long time, and did a little bit of work in his 1982 campaign, voted for him in 18 when he ran for state's attorney, and wanted that to be clear.
Appreciate that.
Kurt, how are you? Welcome.
I'm doing just great.
Good to have
glad
you.
Glad to be with you. Thanks for all that you're doing, and great lead-in and wonderful historical facts.
Thank you. Folks, join us here, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk at steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages. But if you have time, please call us, 410-319-8888. So, Kurt, it's great to have you in the studio. It's been a long time.
Yep. Well, it's a wonderful building and facilities that you have. I must say that years ago when I came on WEAA, was it a different building?
Across campus.
Absolutely. Morgan is just doing so many great things, has a tremendous impact not only in the city and state, but nationally and internationally with all the leaders, the young leaders that are produced by this university. And I'm just amazed. As I look at the campus, drive up Hillen Road, and I say, oh, my, Morgan begins here. and it just continues.
That's true.
So it's just wonderful to see.
Yeah, it's good. It's growing by leaps and bounds, and we're sitting here in the studios in the new Global School of Journalism, which is a brand-new school here at Morgan State University, which is it. So it's exciting.
Right, and communication is clearly so important, too. We see what the problems of the world with miscommunication.
Amen.
So being able to provide leaders for this great new century, I think, is wonderful.
You know, I was thinking about this the other day, that we really are in this city, when you think about it, this metropolitan area, a college town, a very serious college. I mean, we don't ever think of Baltimore and its potential as a college town.
Well, when I was a mayor, my students remind me back in the last century.
Makes it sound so old, Kurt.
It's so old, but literally true. 1987 to 99, but you could see that coming, and that this was a community that ought to be committed to lifelong learning, and that the economy and all the jobs were going to depend on having a great education, and you could just see the major change. Just symbolically, a few days ago, we saw the last of the mills at Bethlehem Steel come down, which was kind of a sign of the times. You know, when I graduated high school back in 1967, Bethlehem Steel, Sparrows Point plant, was the largest private employer in the area. By the time I became mayor 20 years later, Johns Hopkins, the health system and the university combined, was the largest private employer in the city. So you can just see that as a symbol of the changing times, and also as the need for tremendous education and a commitment to lifelong learning.
So I wonder, before we get into some of our specific questions, just about some things you've been doing, things you've been writing and saying, and where University of Baltimore may be going. I mean, and as somebody who was mayor for 12 years, how do you harness that? How do you harness the idea that you've got all these incredible public and private institutions of higher learning, these tens of thousands of young people who are in undergraduate and graduate school in Maryland, and make that kind of the centerpiece for what this community could be? Do you know what I'm saying? We haven't done that yet, seems
well,
to me.
Well, that's one thing that I know that there are many people, particularly in the nonprofit community, have been talking about, emphasizing the strengths of Baltimore, because unfortunately, even though it was an outstanding show, The Wire really put a perception and an image of the city around the world that's pretty negative. And I know that the producers and everything wanted to lift up an important issue that really touches cities around the world, not just Baltimore. But we did suffer from a serious image problem. So now, and I just heard this recently from the president of one of our city-based, the former president of our of MICA, Maryland Institute College of Art. And he said basically that 20 years ago, People were saying that they weren't going to come to MICA because it was located in Baltimore.
Right.
Today, they're saying, I'm coming to MICA because it's located in Baltimore. So there has been an image change, and I think we just have to continue to work on it.
So, and before we get to the phones, I see Bill is called in from Northeast. We're going to come to your call in a minute, and others coming in at 410-319-8888. And I was thinking about that in terms of, we always have this very uneven development. It either seems like it's gentrification for the more well-off, and then people who are at the very bottom or the economic scale, especially poor people who are black in Baltimore, are kind of thrust aside or forced to move and not in the process.
Yeah.
But so I'm figuring out this question of how you connect those two. And
yeah.
One of the things you wrote about before President Barack Obama announced it in his State of the Union address yep. was that we should have free community college.
That's right.
I mean, and this, to me, if people are serious about it, is a linchpin for that kind of development.
Right. What I started to see a development out of, first Tennessee and then Chicago, that basically announced that they wanted to have free community college. And I looked into it, and what Tennessee did was to create a special lottery. You know, we've done that before. We built a couple of stadiums with a special lottery. And I said, you know, this is so important, and there are a lot of young people who just can't afford it. I mean, even though our community colleges are really a great are affordable for most people, but for a lot of students, that price is still too high, and yet they need that in order to advance in their careers. So my view was, you know, let the free community college be sort of the GI Bill of the 21st century. You know, everybody points to the fact that the GI Bill, which, you know, of course, came after World War II, and the government invested in returning veterans and said, you know, we're going to give you support to get education. People recognize that the GI Bill had a tremendous impact on improving the economy of the United States through the latter part of the 20th century. My view is that, you know, let's focus on K through 14, not just K through 12, and open the community colleges up as much as we can to, you know, really help advance the young people and advance our community.
How do we pay for that? You raised that a little bit in your piece you wrote for the city paper, but that's a big question, how that becomes funded or could have been funded.
Yeah, well, it's a combination of things. As I looked into what they actually did in Tennessee and in Chicago, it was not completely free. It was really last dollar scholarships. What they said is, they ask the young people to go and apply for the Pell Grant, the existing Pell Grants. Pell Grants right now, you could get about $5,900. That would cover the cost of many of our community colleges. But if there was a shortage, then the government would pay for that. The student wouldn't have to take out an extra loan. The government would pay for it. How would you do it? Well, you could create a lottery, or you could review your existing budget and maybe reduce the amount of money that's gone in corrections and have it go into education. I think that would be a wise choice.
I'm going to come back to some of this, but let me open the phones here as we talk with Kurt Schmoke, who's now the president of the University of Baltimore. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join in this conversation with Kurt Schmoke. And Bill in Northeast Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, how are you doing, Mark?
Good morning, Bill.
First of all, I just want to thank you for having one of my favorite politicians, the Honorable Kurt Schmoke. Kurt, this is Bill Gooden.
Oh, hi.
And, yes, sir. And basically, I really wanted to call it just to acknowledge your presence there. And to say, you have really been a progressive person as long as I've been knowing you, despite what we agree with and disagree with. And in closing, I just want to ask you about two positions. One thing is that you did support the bill that, the resolution that citizens, it should be a citizens group to watch the incineration process of guns and drugs, as well as that, shouldn't a portion of confiscated money from drug raids come back into our communities to help to rebuild the community? I would just like to hear your perspective on them two issues.
Let me take the latter one. There are a lot of confiscations in the war on drugs, particularly not only drug money, but vehicles and property. And that money really should come back to the budget of the city so it can go into communities. I know Some of it did when I was mayor. I haven't looked at, you know, the current budget to see what they do with that money. But, on you know, that is those kind of vehicle confiscations and things of that nature really should go back to benefit the community. And hopefully over time we'll see fewer and fewer of those confiscations as we make some more progress in what I hope is becoming more of a public health war on drugs rather than a criminal justice war.
You know, it takes me back to when you first became mayor of Baltimore and you attempted to decriminalize drugs in the city, and you were viciously attacked.
Yeah.
And literally, I've been pushed into a corner on this thing.
Well, and what people, you know, I was just trying to explain to folks that, you know, the war on drugs really started in the United States back in 1914 with the passage of the Harrison Act. And, you know, just as President Obama recently said about our Cuban policy, when you do something for 50 years and it has it doesn't have the effect that you want, it's time to change. And so as I looked at things from 1914 to 1988, when I made my statements about the war on drugs, you know, we had been trying to arrest our way out of the problem, and all that it was creating a larger prison industry, and it was hurting families and really not doing very much for safety. And so, you know, I said, let's think about a different approach. And then, of course, we had the added problem of AIDS with people using dirty needles and sharing it with one another, and that spread AIDS. And of course, and then people would have sex with one another, have babies, and the babies would come out with AIDS. So it was, you know, really, as you looked at it, it was not just a crime problem. It was an addiction problem, an AIDS problem, and crime. And two out of three of those are health issues, not criminal justice issues. So I'm just glad, as I look around now, I'm seeing more and more elected officials talking about this as a public health, more of a public health than a criminal justice. I saw just recently the county executive in Harford County talking about the heroin problem. Similarly, the executive in Anne Arundel, and both of them started talking about health first. You know, let's figure out how we reduce the addiction and not just look at incarceration. That's a major change, as you know, Mark. And I know it's taken a lot of people, you included, in you know, talking to folks over and over and saying, wait a minute, you know, let's look at the message here, and it's not just some guy smoking something himself and and going off half-cocked, that indeed there is a reasonable alternative approach to, and I'm just glad that the language at least is more a balance in there. You know, some people, you know, people who are hooked on drug money, those are the people that you know ought to be locked up. But the folks who are you know, addicted to substance itself, you got to look at substance abuse as a health problem first.
So you know, and when you look at your new role here as president of the University of Baltimore, you know, which I'm like, strange. I was pleasantly shocked to see that you made that move back to Baltimore. And I must say, this is an aside, but I always say this to you every time I've seen you in the last 20 years. Since you stopped being mayor of Baltimore, you seem to smile a great deal more.
Well, you know, as Mayor Rawlings Blake can tell you, it's on you all day long. You being mayor, you know, for most people in terms of politics, they can tell you what their expectation is of a mayor and what the expectation is of the president. That is, president's supposed to come on television every day and say something about the country, foreign policy, the economy, whatever. But then you ask, well, what do you expect your U.S. senator to do every day? Very few people have an expectation of that. But how about the mayor? You better move the snow, pick up the trash, get all those things done.
Right.
So, you know, it is something you carry with you. I was honored to do it for 12 years.
Right, obviously.
It was something that, you know, I love the city, and now I have an opportunity to work with young people and trying to nurture them and, you know, create some leaders for, you know, the future. So I'm really committed to it. And but, yeah, it does since when I look at the snow and know that I don't have to move it, that does bring a smile to my face.
And speaking of young people, you participated in the new state's attorney Mosby's inauguration.
Yes. She, it's interesting. I met Marilyn Mosby and her husband, Nick, when I was served as a trustee at Tuskegee University. I was down there at a trustees meeting, and these two young people come running across the campus, and they were waving, saying, "We're from Baltimore, we're from Baltimore." And so I stopped to talk to them, and it's simply amazing that both of them talked about their desire to come back and serve in some way in public service. They didn't give me kind of a game plan, a roadmap of what they wanted to do other than to be involved in public service. So I was just honored, you know, when she asked me to participate in her inaugural. But it did strike me as she was up there with her two little children. When I got up to speak, it just struck me that Marilyn Mosby was 2 years old when I was sworn in as state's attorney. So it's quite a journey.
Let's go back to the phones here. 410-319-8888. And Jay in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Jay.
Speak with you all, and it's especially nice to have former Mayor Smoke on there. Mayor Smoke, I was just thinking about how you were new in and novel thinking in your idea about legalizing marijuana. I just heard about a book called Stopping the Scream, I believe it was, about where they have taken a very different look at drug addiction and finding out that it if you decriminalize drug addiction, then you start to begin to attack the problems with in addiction in our society, and I thought it was very interesting. And I just wanted to know, are you still on that trend of thinking as far as drugs are concerned in our country?
Yeah, I am. You know, when I think about some of the things that we talked about and then implemented in the city, you know, back in the late 80s and 90s, a lot of places around the world now have adopted those programs. For example, when we talked about looking at the drug problem more as a health problem, one of the things we wanted to do was to have a needle exchange program or sterile syringe exchange program in the city. And that was not to say to drug addicts, hey, you know, we're happy to, you know, give you the drugs. What we were saying is that we could reduce the spread of AIDS and help families if we were able to have an ability to give clean needles and also to get people in treatment. And that's what our health commissioner, Peter Bielenson, was able to do. By having that program, he identified addicts, treated them more as patients rather than as criminals, and got them into treatment. That has a huge impact not only on the individual but on the families, whereas incarceration starts to disrupt families, and guys going into prison usually come out and can't get employed, and so they go back to doing criminal activity. So, yeah, I still believe very strongly that this war on drugs has to be a public health war, that it makes sense to take the profit out of distributing drugs at the street level, and that, I believe, is what decriminalization helps us to do. So I think you're on the right path in reading about the books that identify places around the world that have taken a different approach, whether it's Portugal or the Netherlands or some other places, and I think they've really shown benefits that could help Baltimore.
We can have a very brief break and come right back, reminding you on our way to this break, as we talk to Kurt Schmoth, the new president of University of Baltimore, that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com. Or at steinershow.org, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union's banner. And you're listening here to the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. On a way to break, that's the Beatles, Across the Universe, recorded on this day in 1968. We'll be right back with Kurt Schmoke.
Across the universe, pools of sorrow, waves of joy are drifting through my opened mind, possessing and caressing me.
Steiner, and that's James Brown. Please, please, please. Recording this day in 1955. Whew, I am getting old.
Your parents told you about
that's
it.
That's right. I actually saw James Brown, I think it was 1961, at the Royal Theater.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. We have to tell people that it, the shake and bake wasn't on Pennsylvania.
It was not there then. No.
The Royal Theater was. That's right. Okay.
Here with Kurt Schmoke, former mayor of Baltimore, of course, former dean of Howard University Law School, president of the University of Baltimore, 410-319-8888. Jack and Rick in Crofton. Nick in Crofton. Nick, we're going to come to your call in just a moment. So much to talk about here, and a few things I do want to get to. One is, I just think the role of higher education is so critical to the future of this community. And each university and college here is a very different place, mix of private and public and historically black institutions and more. I mean, it's a really vibrant city that way. Mm-hmm. And you're watching what's going on, whether it's here in the work that Morgan's doing and building up the old shopping center and building new buildings and creating new stuff here. You watch where the University of Baltimore is and how that section of Mount Vernon is coming up. Peabody's there. Mike is there. Hopkins is not far away. And Station North Arts is being built up.
That's right.
And so, but here's the question I have. I was thinking about, again, I keep thinking about the juxtaposition between your idea of K through 14 as being a focus,
mm-hmm.
And how important it is in terms of education for the poorest and most discriminated among us to have access to a new life,
right?
But it seems like whenever we develop, it becomes this notion of gentrification, which leaves those who used to live there out, or pushes people who are the poorest among the working class to the margins, rather than make it inclusive and bringing people in.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes by race. I had a conversation with folks who were building on Howard Street a new theater complex, and they're great people. And I said, well, what about, have you contacted any black folks in theater to be part of this? And the answer was, no, but we should. I said, yes, we should.
Right.
That, so how do we make this, both in terms of race and class, a more inclusive development and not keep doing it in the same way we've been doing it, especially since so much of the engine for development is coming from you, the higher institutions,
right,
the higher education institutions.
Yeah, well, I do think it's very important. One of the things is that we have to keep raising that issue because, as we know, Baltimore and the state of Maryland has been a bit schizophrenic in the history of our country. You know, some people wanted to fight for the South, some wanted to fight for the North.
That is our legacy in the state.
And in our city, you know, we have an unfortunate history of residential segregation. I mean, we were the city that led with the restrictive racial covenants on housing, and it just took, you know, years and years, as you know, Antero Pietella's book, you know, talked about the problems of racial discrimination, and all those things just take time to overcome. But I recall one of the things that we did when I was mayor, when we took down the public housing high rises. One of the things that we wanted to do was to make sure that the people that we didn't get kind of resegregated in the poverty and created, instead of those high rises, neighborhoods that looked like the rest of Baltimore. That was an important policy decision, and I think it made a big difference. These are great communities where we used to have gosh, those things were warehouses of poverty, those high-rises. Yeah. But the discussions of race and inclusion are clearly important. They're going on various pockets. I mean, the foundation community, I think, has been a leader in trying to keep those issues in front of us. But, it's just one of those things that we have to be constantly reminded of. And hopefully, I've seen a lot more progress over the past few years than when I was in office. So I think that there's been a lot of leadership in moving those things forward. Our programs now in the arts, we're talking to a lot of different arts institutions about trying to create partnerships that would involve people of all incomes, all races, in kind of an integrated arts program that would, benefit young people in our community and have a big impact on the future of Baltimore.
I mean, especially where you are, I mean, I just that bringing in younger people in community colleges and just bringing more young people of color into places like the Mount Vernon area that you are, your institution is a big part of developing. I mean, this is we could create such a vibrant kind of community that where everybody is included and not just have one where it becomes for the few, or not for the few is not the right word, but only becomes for a selected group.
Yeah, you know, when I looked at the issue of community colleges right now, I was meeting with the new president of Baltimore City Community College, Gordon May. Great guy. had an outstanding record in Michigan, and I know he's going to do wonderful things here. But he told me that Baltimore City Community College now has 18,000 students enrolled in various programs, part-time, full-time. So that's a huge number of young people. And then you start to look in the area, the Community College, Baltimore County has large numbers. And Howard County, I went out to visit with their president, again, 17,000, 18,000 students. So, you know, the young people are saying to us, hey, we think that this is the route. This is going to help us not only get a great education, but deal with the issue of debt, student debt. So,
which is a huge problem.
Absolutely, it can change careers because of a debt load. So you know what we really have to catch up to where the trends are going, and we're trying to do that at the University of Baltimore. We admit a lot of students from community college. We have scholarship programs focused on the community college, and I just think that as a matter of policy, the state ought to do more to improve the community college and make them affordable for all of our young people.
I have some questions about UB, but let me go back to the phones here. 410-319-8888. Nick in Crofton, you're on the air. Hi, Nick. Welcome. You there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome, Nick.
Mark, first I'd like to give you props because I see, you always have informed and very good discussions on the air every day, and I see and hear what's going on at you all's sister station down in Washington, where they're pretty much having a public fight on the air between NPR, I guess it's the parent company or network, and the local programming, and, what you're doing is very good because people need more informed, thoughtful discussion instead of just whatever, So I just wanted to give you props on that.
Thank you.
Former Mayor Smoke, I called, and Mark's call screener, my subject matter, I wanted to ask you about what you thought about Dr. Ben Carson. And I'll say this. I think when anybody, he might be in particular because he should know better being a doctor, but when anybody aligns himself with Tea Partyist, if you take 10 major issues in the United States, I think they're wrong. Now, I'm a Democrat, so I'm going to have this point of view, but I think they're wrong on at least 9 out of 10 of them. And you can see that by the polling. When you're somebody like him who says the Affordable Care Act is akin, or whatever way you put it, to slavery, I really don't get. And I'll tell you what, another thing is, he does a lot of public speaking. I don't hear him say he's from Baltimore very much. And if he thinks that's a source of embarrassment, so be it. But I just wanted to get your take on, that kind of the way that you do your political act, I guess, what you think about that. And I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick.
Thanks, Nick. You know, some respects, watching Dr. Carson in the political realm really pains me. I've known Ben Carson for many, many years. In fact, we were in college together. He's a couple classes behind me, but we were in the same dorm or residential college at Yale. And so I've known him and his wife, Candy, and their children, and worked with him on a number of projects. And clearly, he deserves our accolades for the work that he's done as a surgeon and his leadership in education with the Carson Scholars Program. There are just so many great things to say about him on the medical and education side. But on the political side, I just respectfully disagree with his message and some of the comments that he's made, that one on the Affordable Care Act, the one recently that he talked about same-sex marriage and made the quip that you might have seen in the paper that he said that, you know, people who are bakers shouldn't be forced to bake wedding cakes for people with same-sex marriage. And then he, unfortunately, trying to make a humorous statement, said that those couples should be worried anyway that the baker might put poison in the you know, in the icing of the cake. Well, you know, that got then interpreted as you know, Dr. Carson suggesting that bakers poison the cakes of same-sex couples. That's, you know, clearly not what he meant, but the fact that's, you know, even in jest what came out of his mouth shows you that he's got a long way to go in terms of understanding politics and a politics that would bring people together. So he's doing, you know, kind of involved in the right-wing side of the Republican Party right now. I just disagree with his politics. In terms of the Baltimore connection, he's actually moved to Florida now.
Oh, has he?
So, though he still has, you know, connections up here. But, you know, as I said, forget politics for a moment. He's the type of guy you'd want to sit down with your children and talk about his past and what he's done in education and medicine. But when you get off on politics, that's where we have a substantial disagreement. So with all due respect to my friend Ben Carson, I hope he's not our next president.
Number here is 410-319-8888. Come to your calls in a minute. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Write to us at talkassteinershow.org. And speaking of tweets, Key of Life just tweeted in, "I'm really a big fan. I was in the Baltimore City Public School System when he was mayor, and we had some amazing programs that changed my life. I'm an engineer now, and I hold an MBA from the University of Baltimore. Can't wait to see what President Schmoak has in store for the university."
Yeah, one of the strongest programs that we have there, as you probably know, is in the School of Business. As you probably know, Mark, the University of Baltimore is actually the merger back in 1925 of two schools. There was an evening school of law and a school of business. And so from its origins, it's always been a career-oriented university. Now we have our slogan at the university is knowledge that works.
Right.
It really is. We're trying to make sure that the education works for all who are willing to work for an education. And so I'm proud of when I hear young people have gone through our public school system and then gotten a good education at the University of Baltimore. And one of the things we say to our employers in the community is that overwhelmingly the students that come to UB like to stay in the city and metropolitan area. So you're talking about a very committed workforce, and that's helped a great deal. So we are going to build on a lot of the programs in the past, great accounting programs, a lot of work with real estate development. We have a special program with that, but a wide range of programs. Think that one of them that I actually haven't sat in on the class, but I keep hearing students drawn to is we have a major in simulation and digital entertainment. Now, Mark, you probably know exactly what that's all about, but the bottom line is that the gaming industry in the state is just growing by leaps and bounds. And that's and not the gambling, the actual video games and things like that. But both simulation and we have a digital information major also. But the young people are finding these jobs of the future, not only in the private sector but with some of the great government agencies that are in and around Maryland. So, you know, I'm very impressed with the course selection, the majors that our young people are involved in at the University of Baltimore. And we've just got an outstanding faculty of people who are actually practitioners in their chosen profession.
No, I think it's good. As a matter of fact, what you said about the digital school, I was on the board of advisors at when Neil Kleiman was running the program at the University of Baltimore when they were first developing it years back.
Okay.
And so it's good to see that that is kind of...
continues to grow. And, you know, even, you know, all of our programs, look to the future. And yet we also have programs working with city and state agencies, government agencies that help solve problems. Our Schaefer Center recently did a study about charter schools that's going to have an impact on, you know, the debate.
That's out now?
The study is out, and the question that they looked at was whether the state law on charter schools was helping or hurting the development of these charter schools. And so there will be more discussion, you know, about the programs. I think the bottom line is that they've shown that they're good and bad charter schools. It's not a magic wand, but that should be among the options that parents have for their children, and the state should do all they can to encourage it.
I have a question about that as well, but let me go to the phones here, and then I want to ask you about something I read that you wrote in Politico that I'd been dying to ask you about, which is really a very interesting piece of our American history. But let's go to the phones first at 410-319-8888. Keila in Baltimore County, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello.
Welcome, Keila.
Thank you for taking my call. I agree with the gentleman that drug usage is a public health issue, but... I can't see that legalizing more drugs deals with that. For example, cigarettes, alcohol, those are also legal drugs, and yet they're still abused, and there's a lot of addiction to those also. So I'm a bit confused.
No, it's a great question. But when you think about it, particularly on alcohol, let's focus on that for a moment. What we tried to do back in the 1920s and early 30s, when we saw that there was a serious problem in alcohol abuse, we tried to criminalize it. We passed the constitutional amendment. We made it illegal to possess and distribute alcohol. And so we had this whole period of prohibition. And what we saw by prohibition is that we created a whole criminal underground, that we still had adulterated alcohol being used, that we had children being used as lookouts for speakeasies, and a massive crime wave in the country. And so we simply said, with respect to alcohol abuse, that we would rather treat this as a public health problem, not criminalize it, because by criminalizing it, you create other problems for society. And that's all I'm saying, that we should look at addiction as a health problem, try to provide treatment, things of that nature, for on the public health side. And as you probably know, the largest number of people who are arrested and incarcerated for substance abuse are arrested for marijuana. And I think that, a whole generation of people could tell you that that's something that's usually a youthful indiscretion more than a criminal act, and that we could treat that through our public health approaches. And we've been reducing the number of young people who are smoking by doing it through public health ads, not by criminalizing people. So I absolutely understand your concern. It's a question of a trade-off. We didn't become an alcohol-free America by criminalizing alcohol. We're not becoming a drug-free America by criminalizing the use of these substances. So we need to have a balanced criminal justice system for those who are hooked on drug money or predators on society, but don't use the criminal justice system for those who are addicted, who we think we can move, get off of addiction, and make productive citizens.
So a couple of quick questions here. One has to do with, again, education, but then another piece that you wrote in Politico I want to ask you about.
Was that Calvin Coolidge?
Yeah.
Yes.
We'll get to Calvin Coolidge in a minute. Yeah. That was fascinating. But being a political and history buff, I was really fascinated by that piece you wrote.
Yeah.
But to go on this kind of education first, the we've been wrestling with how to reform Baltimore City schools for a long, long time, right, and how to change them so they're more effective. And now, as president of University of Baltimore, and you will be bringing in numbers of students now that UB takes freshmen, and you're building a dorm, right, to house freshmen.
Right. Right. We've got it's actually the private sector is building it, and they're going to allocate spaces for our freshmen. Yes.
So the question is, I mean, and we talked about charter schools, a study that was just done by the Schaefer Center.
Right.
So what are the conversations are you engaged in?
Yep.
That have to do with changing the nature of how we run our public schools to prepare kids, especially kids we know who are coming from some of the poorest neighborhoods in the inner cities of Baltimore. Really, because of a myriad of reasons,
yep,
need a great deal more attention to kind of bring to the fore.
Right. It's partnership, Mark. Partnership is the key. The city public schools can't do it by themselves. They're resource constrained. Most of the kids in the city public schools are doing well and will go on to be successful. But you have a certain portion that are going to need assistance beyond what can be provided right now. So you have people out here, again, to give you an example, Westmore, who has created a program that is in partnership with University of Baltimore and some other schools. It's called a bridge program that basically gives young people who haven't been very successful in the public schools an opportunity to take additional supplemental courses that would allow them to bridge from public into public schools into community college or University of Baltimore. That's one. There's another program called Year Up that I just saw at the it's hosted at the community Baltimore City Community College. Private sector and the public schools getting together along with the community college and providing opportunity a year of instruction for young people. Also, internships connected with local business. So what I'm saying is that the business community has an obligation or responsibility to partner with the public schools and basically showing young people that there it really is a path to success by being by staying in school and doing a good job. So all of us have to work with the schools and allow them to experiment. You know, it can't be a cookie cutter approach to every young person. They all learn differently. So bottom line is that I think the public school system is on the right path, but it has to be a total community partnership. Goes back again, Ms. Clinton talking about the village. So it does take a village, and the school system can do a great job, but we have to help in creative partnerships.
I'm trying to get another phone call in here, which we will do, but we got to tell the listeners about Calvin Coolidge and this piece you wrote. I was really kind of shocked when I read it. Not a story I remembered for President Calvin Coolidge, what we think of as a conservative Republican.
Absolutely.
But maybe not so much.
That, I know. It just it stunned a lot of people, too. But I was in the building at Howard University one day, and I was walking by, and I looked at a photograph, and it was a photograph of the 1924 commencement. And the speaker was President Calvin Coolidge. And I said, now, I know that some presidents came to Howard. You know, it's located in Washington, D.C., but I never thought of Calvin Coolidge. So I looked into it, come to find out that it was Calvin Coolidge who was the person who initiated the federal government's appropriation of money to Howard at the time. He wanted to do it for the medical school because he thought there needed to be more African-American physicians. But throughout his history, coming out of New England, he had been one who talked a lot about equal opportunity. And the thing that was so amazing to me, and you referenced somebody a little bit earlier when you talked about D.W. Griffith. D.W. Griffith had, created this movie that exalted the Ku Klux Klan, and it was a Democratic president, Woodrow Wilson,
right,
who aired it,
right,
in the White House. So Coolidge comes in you know, following Democratic administrations. I mean, it was Harding, then Coolidge. But bottom line is that Coolidge was the one that talked about all the great things that black soldiers had done during World War I, what the country owed them. He talked about opportunities in education. And then he created this appropriation for Howard University that's still in existence in 2015.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, and his speech, when I saw that, you read that, I went back and read his speech that he gave to Howard University.
Well, it was extraordinary. I mean, LBJ really is, you know, we think about Lyndon Johnson and talking about We Shall Overcome in his speech, but Calvin Coolidge back in 1924 was talking about the same sorts of issues. So it's one of those kind of buried in history, but I was happy to write about it in Politico, and it really did open eyes of many people about that president.
I was stunned. I was really stunned. We have time for one more quick call. 410-319-8888. Very quick call here before we run the top of the hour. Clarence, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Steiner. Mr. Smoke, thank you very much. Even without hard numbers, given the predatory nature of capitalism, I can see legalization of drugs or, you know, creating an even bigger problem than we have now while it's illegal. Maybe less incarceration for society as a whole, you know, that element in capitalism, I think, will create a bigger problem. Thank you, Mr. Steiner.
Right. Thank you so much.
Well, you're correct in being concerned, and that's why I think the state of Maryland is going about this in the right way. You create a commission. You decide that you're going to make a change in policy. I think moving to medical marijuana or permitting that under regulated circumstances is a good first step. And then if you're going to decriminalize further, you ought to have regulations in place so that you can watch it. One of the things that concerned me about Colorado is that when if you go too far, if you move it from everything's you completely open it up to capitalism, you're going to have some abuses. We do know that. So there's a need for good regulation and a nice balance. But I think moving more towards dealing with this as public health rather than criminal justice is the right thing for everybody. It will benefit our communities well into the future.
Well, we never had a chance to talk about Cuba, but maybe next time we will.
Absolutely.
Because I know that you're deeply involved in Cuba. We went to Cuba. Was it 1998 or 9 we went there? 98 that we went there together. And that it's opening here at Morgan State University. It has trips, and it's a very exciting opportunity here for Baltimore and Cuba. We'll start off next time we get together to do that.
Great.
Kirchmo, thanks so much
for
coming in.
Thank you, Mark.
Our new president of University of Baltimore here joining us in studio. We're going to take a very brief break and come right back. And on the way to break here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of community. That is the 19th Nervous Breakdown by the Rolling Stones, released on this day in 1966. We'll be right back.